If you run a Shopify store, listen up. Shopify's got you covered for selling, but when your shipping volume grows and you're juggling multiple plugins just to get orders out the door, you need tools that can keep up. Stop duct taping your shipping workflow and use the tools that work better together, like Shopify and ShipStation. Think of ShipStation as Shopify's dedicated shipping partner. ShipStation goes beyond just shipping labels to save you time and money by automating the entire order fulfillment process, from syncing your orders all the way through inventory management and returns. Automate the rate browser to select the lowest rates on shipments, with discounts up to 90% off major carriers like USPS, UPS, and FedEx. No wonder businesses that use ShipStation grow 3 times faster on average and ship 15 times more orders. See how ShipStation can help you scale and boost your Shopify sales. Go to ShipStation.com and access all features free for 30 days. No credit card or contract required. Cancel anytime. That's ShipStation.com.
I'm John Batchelor with Professor Joseph Postel, writing at Civitas Outlook about a decision I had never read about before. But then again, I did enjoy the education of a law student or a professor reading today, Joseph, so forgive me for being completely amazed by this decision that Congress would have let it go forward. Now, you have corrective suggestions. You tell me that the majority opinion endorsing CHATA, that is to reject the ability of Congress to veto anything unless both houses of Congress, bicameralism, and unless presentment, which means the signature of the president, that's the only time Congress can get in the way. That is both a misinterpretation and there is an opening. To reverse CHATA, is that the ambition here? Reverse CHATA. So let's begin with what's wrong with CHATA. What did the court in the 1980s misunderstand?
The court in the CHATA case engaged in what I call selective formalism. That is, it was right about a matter of original meaning of the Constitution. And the thing that it got right was, anytime Congress wants to pass a law, it has to go through Article 1, Section 7, which means both houses of Congress have to pass the law and the president has to sign it. And that's something we all learn in sort of our, you know, elementary and high school civics classes, that Congress can't make law unless both houses pass the bill and the president signs it. The court was right about that. What the court was wrong about was the question of whether the suspension or the reinstatement of CHATA's deportation was a legislative act. That's the thing the court got wrong. Or to put it more broadly, what the court got wrong was calling legislative vetoes legislative acts. Legislative vetoes are not legislative acts. They are reversals of executive acts promulgated by the administration. That's the reasoning that our court has adopted throughout the whole of its non-delegation jurisprudence. And what I mean by that is, when Congress initially grants the power to the executive to make certain decisions, let's take an example like declaring an emergency and using that emergency to institute tariffs. The Supreme Court has held that Congress can delegate those decisions over to the president because those decisions are not legislative. Well, if those decisions are not legislative, the decision to veto those decisions by Congress is also not legislative and therefore not subject to those bicameralism and presentment requirements. In other words, the Supreme Court applied its reasoning in one way, but it failed to do so consistently. And this is what led to the distorted result in CHATA.
You also mentioned that Justice Rehnquist, in dissent, has an opening for not the reversal, but the correction of CHATA. What was his dissent that's significant to you?
Yeah, so what I just sketched out was the argument for just reversing CHATA altogether. Which I would prefer. But if the court is not willing to do that, it should consider what Justice Rehnquist said in his dissenting opinion about the question of severability. And this idea of severability is a legal idea that says, if you're going to strike down one part of a law, you can't sever it from the rest of the law unless Congress would have wanted you to do that. Well, in the case of the legislative veto, it's very clear to me that Congress passed these laws giving the president power only because it knew that it would have the power to reverse those decisions if it disagreed with the president. In other words, you can't sever the legislative veto provisions in these delegations of power to the president from the delegations of power themselves. if you're going to strike down the legislative veto, you have to strike down the whole delegation of power to the president, because Congress would not have passed one without the other. And I think in many of these cases, Congress today would not endorse a situation in which the president can act unilaterally and the Congress can't reverse those decisions through something like a legislative veto. So the court should take up the severability question if it's unwilling to overrule Chadha altogether.
What I think I've just understood from you is that Chadha, those in favor of Chadha, present to me that the Congress wanted to give away power permanently, that was his intention. Is that what they're saying?
Those who favor Chadha, I don't think they even think about this question. I think they just think about the pure question of whether Article 1, Section 7's bicameralism and presentment requirements apply. And in this way, they don't really think about the long-term effects of the decision and how it's weakened the separation of powers and how it's weakened Congress. It seems to me that they haven't even really considered the severability question. And in fact, I think very few people have considered that severability question since the case was handed down, even though, in spite of the fact that it's so critical.
The president right now, something called presidentialism. Is this a consequence of, as you also include in your essay, mention of Chevron? Chevron strengthens presidentialism and Chadha protects it. Is that the way to think of these?
I think that's exactly right. And the Chevron case really strengthened the executive branch. And the Chadha decision ensured that the legislature wouldn't get in the way when the executive makes policies. And I think Chevron's reversal just recently by the Supreme Court really opens the possibility of reconsidering Chadha, which I think has to be thought of as hand in glove with the Chevron decision.
All right, here's the puzzle, Professor. I've learned as an outsider that Justice Roberts favors Congress in all questions of conflict. Favors the first article over the second article, which is logical. He's the third article. Is that incorrect? Have I misinterpreted Roberts' sympathetic remarks about Congress going first, the court not wanting to legislate, or did he change his mind?
I think that Roberts' jurisprudence is more complicated than that. I think certainly in the case of the removal power, which has been really front and center in the Supreme Court's deliberations recently, the decision of whether to overturn Humphrey's executor, Chief Justice Roberts has been among the leaders on the court in getting the so-called unitary executive theory to gain purchase.
That's question whether the president can fire a member of an independent board.
That's right. And that's that enormous precedent, Humphrey's executor from 1935, is potentially in the crosshairs. The court just heard oral argument on that recently. I think Roberts has been a leader on the court in getting the court to think about this unitary executive theory, and he's very much a believer in the power of Article II. So I think Roberts came up in the Justice Department in the Reagan administration. He celebrated the Chadha case when it was handed down. And I think Roberts is very much in favor of a strong executive. So I wouldn't say for sure that he is somebody who favors Congress.
There is, however, right now, raging controversy over tariffs, which you mentioned earlier. Is that something that would be affected by Chadha?
It has been dramatically affected by Chadha. The original statute that's at issue now, the emergency statute, in which the president can declare an emergency and then, according to the administration, use the power of this statute, the emergency statute, to make tariff regulations. The declaration of an emergency was originally subject to a legislative veto. Congress could, by one house in a simple majority, without going to the president for signature and potentially a veto, Congress could reverse the decision to declare an emergency. And if that legislative veto provision were still in place, a simple majority in Congress could repeal the emergency designation and repeal the tariffs. So the tariff issue has been dramatically and enormously affected by what the court did in Chadha.
In your reading, because you bring to this a great depth of knowledge about Chadha, is Congress aware of this backdoor?
Congress was aware of what had happened in the middle of the 1980s, but nobody, as far as I can tell, in Congress has thought much, in the current Congress, has thought much about this.
To your knowledge, is anyone bringing it forward? Are we going to see this addressed in future at the court?
Not with respect to the tariffs. So what Congress did after Chadha was handed down is it revised the law saying, well, we're not going to use legislative vetoes anymore. We're going to present all of these vetoes to the president. If we exercise a veto, so to speak, the president has to sign it. Well, that essentially ended the legislative veto. But there's one statute where Congress did not do that, where there's one statute where Congress kept the opportunity to pass a simple majority concurrent resolution without having the president's signature. And that's the War Powers Resolution. Okay. So there's still a provision in the War Powers Resolution that lets Congress repeal or reverse a president's decision to engage in hostilities abroad by a simple majority. And given what's going on in Venezuela or outside of Venezuela right now, that could be the other hot issue where the legislative veto would make an enormous difference.
Joseph Postel of the Hillsdale College, writing at Civitas Outlook. I'm John Bachelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Bachelor.
Quick, choose a meal deal with McValue. The $5 McChicken meal deal, the $5 McDouble meal deal, or the new $6 Daily Double meal deal. Each with its own small fries, drink, and four-piece McNuggets.
There's actually no rush. I'm just excited for McDonald's.
For a limited time only, prices and participation may vary. Not valid for McDelivery.
This time of year, most of us are checking off our holiday gift lists. But identity thieves have lists too, and your personal information might be on them. Protect your identity with LifeLock. LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second and alerts you to threats you could miss. If your identity is stolen, LifeLock will fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. Make this season about joy, not identity theft, with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.
This is Julian Edelman from Dudes on Dudes with Gronk and Jules. Sunday mornings, I've got my game day ritual. Coffee, lucky socks, and now new morning Uncrustable sandwiches.
It's all about that 12-gram protein boost with the new Uncrustables Bright-Eyed Berry or Up and Apple flavors.
Bright-Eyed Berry's got a feisty receiver energy.
Up and Apple, your classic do-it-all tight end.
Soft, pillowy, packed with protein, and easy enough for Gronk to grab from the freezer.
Whether you're on the couch, driving to the tailgate, or heading to the locker room, new morning Uncrustable sandwiches are the MVP of snacks.
Your new Sunday kickoff ritual starts here with new morning Uncrustable sandwiches packed with 12 grams of protein.